Blog Talk Radio.
Don't you let nothing hold us back. We're gonna put our shirt together. Gonna polish up our red crown. And if you never been held down before, I know you refuse to be held down anymore. Well, don't you let nothing stand in your way. I want your
read vocabulary to others. You don't need to have a philosophical bent to grasp. There are three little words. We want to let the world know that these words describe what we mean and what we are determined to do about racial injustice. One is the word all. We don't want some of our rights. We don't want a few token handouts here and there. We want all of our rights. There are some people who say that we need to go back to Africa. And there are some others who tell Negroes in the South, leave the South. You can't be free, so get out. But down in Alabama and Mississippi and Georgia, South Carolina, we'll send something else. We want all. We want all of our rights here in Alabama and Mississippi and South Carolina. Then there's a third word. It's the word now. We're not willing to wait 100 years for our rights. We're not willing to wait 50 years for what is ours on the basis of the Constitution of this United States and the authority of God. No, we are not willing to wait another 25 years for our rights. We can hear voices telling us to slow up. We can hear voices telling us to cool off. Our only answer in conversation turn must be that we have cooled off too long, and if we keep cooling off, we'll end up in a deep freeze. We must go on and say, what we are saying to this nation is that we want all of our rights. We want them here, and we want all of them not next year, not next week, but we want them now at this hour. This is what we're saying.
What your life can truly be. Shining star for you to see. What your life can truly be.
It is Friday night, and you know what that means. That means you are at the Black Business Billionaires Network Club. The Black Business Billionaires Network Club. The Black Business Billionaires Network Club. And you, my sir, you, my sister, you, my brother, you can be in the club, and you can be a part of the club, and you can be a black billionaire. People don't realize that poverty is a mindset. Poverty is a mindset, and it's a structure. And just as well as you can skillfully be impoverished, and that means that you could do things in which you can survive under those conditions of poverty, you can also use those same set of skills to uplift yourself to another economic level. As many people have done in the past, many people have lifted themselves up from poverty to wealth. You know, we have a saying here at the Black Business Billionaire Network Club. You can go from a thousandaire to a millionaire to a billionaire, but you got to stop somewhere. And maybe you can get to a trillionaire, but you got to start somewhere. You got to start. And it starts with your mind, your spirit, your connection to the Creator, and where you want to be. Where do you want to be in life? There's a whole bunch of people that really don't want to be wealthy. They're not interested in obtaining wealth. They're not interested in getting up to that level. There's a many, many people out here that have an impoverished behavior. And, you know, the ability, it takes this much work to skillfully live in poverty and struggling economically and middle class and whatever the classes there are, then it would take you to skillfully work your way up to a thousandaire, a millionaire, and a billionaire. The same skills that you're using to survive in a meager economic situation, the same skill that you're taking to survive in the economic situation that you're in, you can take those same skills and use those skills to uplift yourself to a better economic condition. And yes, I know there's systemic racism. I know there are things that are holding people back. I know there are things that are happening in the country that causes conditions of poverty. And I know that, you know, we have a lot to be desired to change these conditions as well. So we want you, ma'am and sir, young man, young woman, little man, little woman, we want you to know that you are what God says you are. God never called nobody to poverty. God never said, oh, there should be, you know, these people are impoverished. He said, the poor you always have with you, because poor in spirit, poor in mind, poor in structure. You know, so poverty is a frame of mind. And a lot of people have that frame of mind where they're impoverished, they're in poverty, and they don't realize how much time and effort that they're putting into marginalizing themselves, how much time and effort they're putting into wasting a lot of energy and a lot of money to be impoverished. They don't realize that, you know, poverty takes just as much work as it takes to be wealthy. And so a lot of people are not aware of the conditioning that they go through. So we here at the Black Business Billionaires Network Club, we know we always telling people there's opportunities to change their condition, to change their life, to move up. We want to encourage you to change your condition, move up a notch, you know, go from unemployment to unemployment to employed, go from welfare recipient to graduate recipient to an award recipient, go from financial challenge to financial advantage, financial success, all in your head. You can be extremely successful if you try. If you put the content together to be successful, you can make it. There's obvious a lot of things that people have done in United States of America to cause economic divide, to cause people to economically struggle, and people have become complacent. People have taken up behaviors that impoverished them, that put them in a condition of poverty. And people have to see things from a different perspective. They have to look from another point of view, you know. And that's where we at the Black Business Billionaire Network Club. We're here to show you a different way, to give you a different mindset, to uplift you, to put you in the condition that you know that you can overcome these circumstances that you're dealing with, and that you know that there's good opportunities for you to better yourself, and that if you desire, the Bible said God would give you a heart's desire. If you desire to move up, to live a better life, and you live a life pleasing unto God, and you stay within the confines of the Creator, He will bless you. He will lift you up to another whole nother status. He said that I would that you prosper and be in good health. He wants you to prosper. He wants you to have good health. He wants you to move forward. Society do not determine your destination. Your relationship with the Creator is extremely important. Your relationship with the Creator, that's where you find ways and means to upgrade and to better yourself. And we want you, sir, ma'am, to look at bettering yourself. We want you to be encouraged. Know that with God with you, who can be against you? Your success is based on your relationship with Christ and how you see yourself individually. Where do you want to be? Where are your aspirations? Where's your encouragement? Where's your hope? Where's your dreams? You know, Where is that spark of interest in something else? You know, children are very hopeful. They have dreams. They have desires. They have wants. And once they lose that, it's incredible how it can destroy the spark in the child, that the child would not continue to seek success and want to be successful. And they turn themselves into a young man, a young woman, a teenager, a lot of times self-destructing or destructing others. And this is what we do not want in our society. We do not want young people to find themselves in a position of being able to deal with society and what's going on. We don't want people to just not advocate for themselves and others. We don't want people to become complacent with a commonality of just a marginalized life, just a little get over, let me just live a little bit. You know, we don't want people to live in that kind of existence. We want people to be encouraged. We want people to be happy. We want people to be motivated, and we want people to be moving forward in the society. We want people to change their lives so that they can change the lives of their family members, so they can change the lives of their children. The children with hopeless children is a sad, sad thing to see young boys and girls with no hope, no dreams, no desires to do anything further with their life. And it's a sad state of affairs. It's really, really sad to see that kind of conditioning of people, how people are conditioned to be marginalized, how people are conditioned to just live a life that's so unworthy of what God is offering to them. What God tried to offer and what God tried to give to the people, you know, it's so sad to see them just live a marginalized life, you know, live a life that's not pleasing unto God, living a life that's not uplifting to God as well. Let's hear a song about love and changing one's inside and outside.
You love me, it's special, live different. Every time you keep me on my feet, happily excited. Your cologne, your hands, your smile, your intelligence. You woo me, you caught me, you tease me, you please me, you school me. Give me something to think about, ignite me.
Excited by
different and special in every way imaginable. You love me from my hair follicle to my toenails. You got me feeling like the breeze, easy and free and lovely and me. Oh, when you touch me, I just can't control it. When you touch me, I just can't hold it. The emotion inside of me, I can feel it.
We were talking about economics and psychological economics and how one feels about an individual self. You should feel great about yourself. You should feel that God, the creator, whoever you call him, Allah, Buddha, Jah, you know, whatever you feel, the creator is such a great, he created you. He created you uniquely. He created you for a purpose. He got you in divine order of humanity. He has a reason for you. He has a purpose for you, and he's bringing you forward. So this is just a great opportunity for your life. Life is a great opportunity. I mean, you only get one, and you only get X amount of years to perform and do what you need to do. Enjoy life. Put time into creating a wonderful life for yourself. You only get a certain amount of time to do that. And, you know, I was telling my grandkids, you know, one day I was 7 and 5 and all these numbers, and then now I'm here, 70, you know, I'm here now after all these years, passing all certain levels of grades, of ages, and you're here, you know what I'm saying? So you only get a certain amount of time to do something exciting in your life, to do something great, something grand. You know, you could be a Dr. King, you can be an Aristotle or Socrates, you can be a great man, you know, you can be a great woman, you can make history, you know, like so many have made history in the past. People continue to make history, you know, Luke and John and Matthew made such tremendous history in the biblical times. And God said the Bible will be written in the future by more people like Luke, John, and Matthew, et cetera, Job, you know. We will be creating more books, new books. So we will be looking at different aspects of life in terms of how we take on life, take on the challenges of life, and how we bring it forward and how we make it happen. It is tremendous. It's tremendous, tremendous opportunity. Life is a tremendous opportunity, and you must take it as quick as you can. You must put it into perspective, and you must work life. You must make every day a special day. Make every day a special day in your life. Make every day a special day for you. In your life, make every day special. Make sure that you take each day and you expand on it. You make it special. I could have named this many, many things, the black whatever, the black club, the black boat club, the black car club, the black whatever club. I made the black billionaires club because folks should take every day that serious. you should have goals and aspirations. You should want to leap up beyond the condition that you're in now. You should have the ability to do that as well. And you should feel comfortable in those concepts and those realities. You should feel extremely happy to develop yourself into the person in which God has made you to be. What God wants you to be, how God sees you in this life and where God wants you to be. So the opportunity there is as great as it can get. It is great as it can get, and it's so great and so honorable, this opportunity to be great, to do something great. And I'm telling you, it takes just as much skill and work to be impoverished, probably more, than to be a man and woman of God, to be a successful man and woman, to be driven to do great things in your life. Opportunities awake you in many different ways. The Black Billionaires Network Club, we all started off with nothing and worked our way up. You can work your way up from a job near to a thousandaire. And from there, you can work your way up to a millionaire. From a millionaire, you can work up to a billionaire. From a billionaire, if you're really, really excited about life and you're really, really hardworking and willing to put the time in, you can go up to trillionaire status. The thing about it is you're in an environment where the rich get richer. Because why? Because they're working towards that. The poor get poorer, and I might get kickback from this, but they're working towards that. Whatever you work for, whatever you desire, when you get up in the morning, whatever you make your mind want to be, I made my mind up to be a businessman, to be a millionaire many, 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 many moons ago as a young boy at 10 years old, and I succeeded at 18. You have to have goals in your life. You have to have a roadmap on how to get there. It's so important that you know what you want out of life and you go for it. You put the time and the effort in to get it. You know, you work towards that end. You know, because you're going to have to, either way, you're going to have to work. If you're poor, you have to work. You have to work in poverty. You have to work on trying to survive. You're going to work in trying to stay alive and trying to pay for your apartment, buy clothes, take medicine, keep clothes on your back, food in your stomach. It's just work. It's work. You have to work to get rich, work to get a job, work to become a middle class, work to become a thousandaire, work to become a millionaire, work to become a billionaire. You have to work. It's an equal amount of work. You can work in being middle class, you can work in being upper middle class, you can work in being impoverished, you can work in being poor. It's going to take work. And a lot of people do not work towards changing their status, upgrading. You know, you should be, that's what you should be working for. You should be working to change your status, change who you are, go forward, go up, go to a different position in life. That's what you should be doing. That's where you should be at. That's what life is about. Life is starting one place and ending up in a better place. Life is about elevation, going from the lower level up into the middle level, up into the top level. Moving forward, the necessity of life. Are you encouraged? Are you a person willing to take a challenge? That's why people in sports are so good at being successful, because they take on a challenge every time they get on the field, the track, the mat, the ring, whatever their physical body takes them, and whatever type of sport they're in, they're taking on a challenge. Life is a challenge. When you stop challenging life and you drop out of the challenge of life, then that's when the problems come. That's when you end up in trouble. That's when you gotta try to find your way. We're gonna go for a commercial break, and we're coming back. Hopefully we have our guest, Mr. Kenneth Lamont and Mrs. Tiki Williams, which our special guest tonight. We're gonna talk about credit, all about credit, all about real estate. Mr. Kenneth Lamont has been 20 years in the business. He's been working every aspect of it. He's had 13 years of advocating for credit. He's a credit advocate, and he's working tremendously hard. And he's going to show us the loopholes in the laws and how to use the laws to benefit you in this way, how you can benefit from the tax laws and how you can use it to increase your tax score, your credit score, your FICO score, how you can use the laws to increase it. We're going to go to a commercial break, and we shall be right back.
Yeah. Oh. Entertainment. Worldwide. We on live. We in your speakers. And on your mind. Ten o'clock. We on time.
Yes, this is Lenny Williams. I'm out here in Oakland, California.
I'm Lisa Ray. I sign on a payment with the NWA, Dr. Dre, and Eazy-E.
It's Just Will, Black Pearl Entertainment Artist, newly signed to I Am Jesus Records. You're listening to the Entertainment Worldwide Network with Don Jr., CEO. Coming to you live, this is business, so pay attention.
Yo, it's your boy LV the Slap Thing, and I'm over here chilling with my guy, The Plug, Don Jr., CEO, Entertainment Worldwide Network Radio. You dig?
What's good, homie? It's your boy, Big D.
It's your folk, Chuck and Traps.
This your peeps, Captain Mac.
I let your boy, Boss Lena.
It's your boy, Brick Boy Rico.
It's your boy, Joe Dirt.
Hey, yo, what up? It's your boy, Buddha, a.k.a. Buddy Miles.
Yo, what's good? It's Severe Percy Jones.
And Big Cell is now in your area.
Yo, this your boy, Mr. Hamson.
It's your girl, Lady Duet.
It's just Rich Gates.
This your bro, JT, Mr. Guaranteed the Rick.
Yo, this your dude, Insane G.
What up? This your boy, Jihad, a.k.a. J Hood.
Yo, this your folks, Young Birds.
Yo, this your folk, GB. Cooney.
Yo, this is Mike G Jungle. Hey, what it do? It's your boy Size Money.
This your boy Big Chad Domingo.
Bye bye. Salute the big dog.
This your boy J Futuristic.
This your folk Lil Raheem. You dig?
I am Geronimo Beals. Off the deep end, getting blessings. Wise Life Records, and you're listening to the Entertainment Worldwide Network with Don Jr., the CEO, coming to you live.
Hey, what it do? This is Charlie Boy, the Versatile Child.
You're listening to the hottest radio station.
Are you ready to be inspired, uplifted, enlightened, and entertained? Judge Joe Brown is an all-American judge, lawyer, and television personality. Judge Joe Brown was raised in the Crenshaw District of Los Angeles, California. Overcoming the harsh streets of L.A., he graduated at the top of his class from Dorsey High School. He then went on to earn his bachelor's degree in political science at UCLA. Judge Joe Brown is a member of the Phi Alpha fraternity and became the first African-American prosecutor in Memphis, Tennessee. He then opened his own practice before becoming a judge on the state criminal court of Shelby County, Tennessee. Judge Joe Brown was then thrusted into the national spotlight for sitting over James Earl's last appeal for race conviction for the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He then caught the attention of producers of Judge Judy and is now the arbiter of his own arbitration-based reality court TV show that has been recorded for over 16 years. This show is syndicated on Bounce and available to millions of homes across America. Judge Joe Brown has been on a mission to educate the leaders of the future and has started a movement titled SAG Pants Equals a SAG Mind. This is a call to action. Let's talk and change the world. Judge Joe Brown is ready to speak at your next event. Follow Judge Joe Brown at Judge Joe Brown TV on Twitter. This message has been brought to you by 2 Deep, owner of KFSM Radio and Bloody Rain Productions, and Pastor Don Jr., CEO of the winning team. Contact 2 Deep at 337-936-5176 or Pastor Don Jr. at 818-358-4255. 5722.
The NEO Project is a business network collective of professional CEOs, community leaders, doctors, recording artists, label owners, lawyers, judges, business owners, entrepreneurs, recording artists, and major connections across the globe. For more information, visit www.myprojectneo.org or call 800-249-8830. We have a live conference call. Join in the conversation hosted by Dr. Rev Robinson Sr. and Dr. Winborn. Share your ideas about growing your business. New ideas, featured partner, video promo, social media, exposure, rotation, profit sharing, meetups at your establishment. Join the conference call on Blog Talk Radio Thursday and Friday, 7 p.m. East Coast, 4 p.m. West Coast time. Sunday, 7 p.m. East Coast, 4 p.m. West Coast time. Live Talk with Eva. Call 347-857-1311. Press 1 to speak on freeconferencecall.com. Saturday, 12 p.m. East Coast, 4 p.m. West Coast time. Call into 515-604-9642. Access code 910488. If you have Metro PCS, hashtag T-Mobile or Boost Mobile, call 206-451-6043, then 515-604-9642, access code 910488. If you have Metro PCS, T-Mobile, or Boost Mobile, dial 206-451-6043, then 515-604-9642, access code 910488. Financial consulting and investments, call DSNR Consultants LLC Corporate Office, 914-363-9007. Text 518-866-7605. Email RevRunRobinson, RevRun11@gmail.com. Shout out to Pastor Don, Jr. CEO, and Keisha Miss, CEO, and the 300 Elite members, also 3 Max and a Nerd, and Andrea's Talent Management.
Fashion is SoSeductiveLive.com. Log on to SoSeductiveLive.com. SoSeductiveLive has the best apparel from Gucci, Prada, Fendi, Guess, Rolex, Nike, Tiara Michelle, True Religion, Louis Vuitton.
Greetings, I'm Miss K, CEO and founder of SoSeductive Shoes and Fashion. I started my company to keep you informed. Log on to SoSeductiveLive.com. I believe in fashion, so SoSeductive is fun and needs to be seen. I want to inspire people just like you. I want someone to look at me and say, because of you, I didn't give up. Log on to SoSeductiveLive.com. I am Miss K, CEO and founder of SoSeductive Shoes and Fashion. You can find me on your favorite social network at Keisha Miss CEO. Log on to SoSeductiveLive.com.
There's a lot to learn in the music business, and without a teacher, it gets even harder and very costly. Introducing the Green Dragon Record Breaking Blueprint. Don Jr., CEO of the Entertainment Worldwide Network, has put together a detailed book to take your career to the next level in the entertainment business. The Green Dragon Record Breaking Blueprint will teach you the do's and don'ts of the entertainment industry, starting from the beginning to the end. The Green Dragon Record Breaking Blueprint covers the topics of business plan, logo design, CD design layout, sales, radio airplay, CD marketing strategy, massive emailing, CD sales one sheet, press kit, media kit, online media kit, internet marketing, MP3 online distribution, hip-hop blog sites, hip-hop magazines, hip-hop DVDs, mixtapes, street teams, music publishing and royalties, music lawyers, tour booking, and more. The Green Dragon Record Breaking Blueprint is available only by contacting Don Jr., CEO, at 818-358-5722 or email donjrceo@gmail.com.
Do you need more exposure? Do you need more fans? Are you planning to be wealthy and successful in business? The 365 Days of Radio campaign is a business training program teaching you how to build your brand, business, product, or service. How to meet and network with people in other cities. How to make connections with other business owners. And how to talk about your business on an open platform. All the tools you need before you speak to investors, advertisers, and or sponsors. Are you ready to receive money and make it to the next level? Education is the key to success. And experience is the best teacher. Learn from the comfort of your own personal remote location. The 365-day radio campaign is a business training program. For business training, tuition, schedules, and fees, please call Pastor Don Jr., CEO, and the winning team at 818-358-5722. That's right, Pastor Don Jr., CEO of the winning team at 818-358-5722.
Entertainment worldwide. work. We on live. We in your speakers. Can't know your mind. 10 o'clock.
We are back. We are back. We are back on the Black Business Billionaires Network show. Okay, we're going to take another commercial break and get back with you as well. Yeah, we're going to get another commercial in here. Some important information we'd like you to know.
We live in dangerous times, and you never know when you'll need a lawyer. Introducing Legal Shield. Get legal help 24/7. For over 47 years, people from all walks of life have joined our community and our mission to empower and protect. Wait, there's more! Become a sales associate and watch your commission grow with every sale. We are working together to change the negatives into positives. Business owners, entrepreneurs, recording artists, and major corporations all across the globe. We focus on business education, advertising, so that everyone can see the return on their investment. Visit our website at robinsonir38.wearelegalshield.com. Or for more information, contact Dr. Ron Robinson at 914-363-9007 or 203-515-7167 or 914-530-5876. Again, visit us at our website at www.robinsonr38.wearelegalshield.com.
If you have ever owned a slave, please raise your hand. Slavery is not our fault. We didn't do it. We didn't cause it. It's not our responsibility, but it is our shared history. And when we try and turn it into something that it's not, when we try and make more light of it than it was, then we are denying who we really are, and we are impeding our ability to truly move forward as a community or as a nation.
In most cases, in the South, that's the way it worked, because they were treated as family, and they knew what they had. They didn't know what they were being faced with if they left.
So your view is that enslaved people were treated as family?
That's basically the way it was down South.
So what I want to talk to you about is part of the ugliness of our history. I want all of us to understand just how we laid the groundwork to own other human beings as property.
And so I think what I'm looking at are shackles that were designed for an adult male and shackles that were designed for a child of maybe 3 or 4.
Yes, yes.
41 of the 56 people who signed the Declaration of Independence owned other human beings as property. When they were talking about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, they saw that as being completely consistent with enslaving people.
Question. What kind of things happened here?
Lynchings or hangings took place here on this very spot.
Black folks here in Charleston refer to it as the lynching tree.
America has demonstrated its greatness time and time and time again, and America is one of the most racist countries on the face of the earth. Those two things are not mutually exclusive. It is not an either or.
There must be a revolution of values in our country, because some of the values that presently exist are certainly out of line with the idealistic structure that brought our nation into being.
I was 11 years old in 1968, and to my young eyes, we had been on a path toward racial justice that was amazing. There was the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, and we were seemingly, to me, at a tipping point where we were either going to roll forward with this incredible momentum on racial justice, or we could roll back. And then April 4th happened, and King got shot in the neck, and it felt like
the whole thing just rolled back.
And a man grabbed me by the arm and said, we don't allow blacks in the gym. And I remember turning to y'all and I said, they've got a problem with the clock and with what's going on here. We all are out here. We're leaving.
I didn't know that.
I figured not.
Once again, America is having to look at issues of race dead in the eye. And once again, we are at a tipping point. And the reason I'm asking us to think about this is that literally the future is at stake.
And Larry, he came out with his hands in the air and said, don't shoot. Put the shotgun in his stomach and pulled the trigger. It closed range.
And what I'm going to ask us to do tonight is to have a naked lunch moment with race in America. It's that moment when everyone has to take a look at what is really on the end of their fork.
If I may ask you a question, Jeff. Perhaps if Dylann Roof was educated, if he understood that he may not have gone down this path, what are your thoughts?
This is not going to be easy, but I can promise you this. It will never get easier to have an honest discussion about race in America than it is right now. Because if we wait, it is only going to get harder.
The Larry that you heard referred to in that trailer was a young man named Larry Payne, who was 6 years older than I was, and he was killed in Memphis, Tennessee the week before King was assassinated, 1 week to the day. There was a march in support of striking sanitation workers, and that march broke into violence. Larry was confronted by a police officer who put a shotgun in his stomach and pulled the trigger. And his memory has been one of the things that's been forgotten about the garbage strike and the movement in Memphis. So I am Jeff Robinson, and I am a criminal defense lawyer from Seattle, Washington. And you could be asking, why are you here and why are you doing this? And that would be a completely legitimate question. And this is the way I'm going to answer it. In 2011, I became a parent because my wife's younger sister, Jeannie, who lived in Queens, New York, was suffering from MS and she passed away. And her 13-year-old son, Matthew, my nephew, then became my 13-year-old son because he was being raised by Jeannie and Jeannie's mother. Jeannie passed away in April of 2011, and her mom, my wife's mom, passed away in November of 2011. So Matt lost both of his parents. His father was never in the picture, and he moved to Seattle. Now, I was terrified about being a parent because I didn't know anything about how to do that, and I was scared a lot. But I was more scared because there was a young black man that moved into my home. And my work as a criminal defense lawyer in Seattle had been for 30 or 35 years working on issues of racial justice, working on issues for clients of color, working and speaking around the country on these issues. They were very important to me, but they were academic to a certain extent until Matthew showed up on my doorstep. And I got scared. And one of the reasons I was scared is that there had been a narrative going on in America about young black men for more than a decade, and it went something like this.
They are often the kinds of kids that are called super predators. No conscience, no empathy. We can talk about why they ended up that way, but first we have to bring them to heel.
Bring them to heel. As soon as you start talking about human beings like they're animals, get ready for some really bad shit to come. Because that's how we do it in America. We dehumanize people before we start to treat them as less than human. And so I was scared and I didn't know what to do, and I just started reading. And as I started reading, I was shocked. I didn't even know what I was looking for. But I started reading facts about our history in America that I had never seen before, that I had never heard before. And it was just scaring me, and it was shocking me. And it was shocking me because, as I said in that clip, I was born in Memphis, Tennessee in 1956 and was assassinated in 1968. The civil rights movement wasn't something I read about in a book. It was what we were living when we stepped out the door of our house in the black neighborhoods in Memphis, Tennessee every day of our lives. And yet I was reading about these facts about our history that I had never heard before. I have had one of the best educations in America. I went to Marquette University and Harvard Law School, and nobody ever taught me this stuff. And so I felt humiliated, and then I felt angry because I thought, well, how come nobody taught me this? And so I thought, I'm going to forgive myself and get pissed off at my teachers, and I'll blame them. And then I thought, well, how could they have taught me if they weren't taught? And the amazing thing about this stuff is that these facts are hiding in plain sight. All you have to do is go and look, because human beings from the time of the cave drawings in France that are 30,000 years old, human beings have a trait that has always been part of our existence. When we think we're doing something important, we write stuff down, and we keep it so people can read it later. And our history from the time the colony started is written down in plain fact for anybody that wants to take a look. And so I started to take a look, and I started to do these presentations about 7 or 8 years ago. And as they developed, I kept doing them, and I gave a presentation in 2017 in New York City. And one of the people in the audience was a woman named Sarah Kunstler. Is Sarah's father-in-law in the audience? Do I hear anybody? Yeah. Could you stand up and introduce yourself, please?
My name is John Ferguson. I'm Sarah's father.
Thank you, John, for coming, and I please give him a hand. Because Sarah Kunstler is the daughter of the famed civil rights lawyer William Kunstler. And Sarah came up to me after the presentation and said, I'd like you to meet my sister Emily, because we own a film company and we'd like to make a documentary about your presentation. And I thought that was the most stupid thing I had ever heard in my entire life. 1 year later, we are performing in Town Hall Theater on Broadway in New York City in front of a sold-out audience with 7 cameras filming. And since that time, we have gone across America filming interviews to put together a documentary called Who We Are, A Chronicle of Racism in America. What I'm here to do tonight is to give you an idea of what this documentary will cover and to give you a sense of the arc of the documentary, because I think that's perhaps the most important thing about this film is the arc that we're trying to cover. When people talk about slavery and atrocities that have happened in our past, what we often hear is, yeah, but that was a long time ago. It doesn't have any impact on the way things are today. And that's something that I want to challenge with this film. And so what I'd like to do is to walk through 4 segments of this arc. And this won't be everything that the documentary covers, I promise you that. But it will give you a flavor for the things that I think can make America look at who we are differently and can make us take steps that we have not yet taken in our existence. This stuff was hiding in plain sight. The term white supremacy is a difficult term and an extreme term, and I think it is used, and some people feel that it might be overused. What I want you to consider is that white supremacy was one of the founding pillars of American society. Now, if you think that's an overstatement, in the documentary, we will walk through the historical documents that will lay this out clearly. But some of what you'll see is that we know in 1619 we have these records of 20 and odd enslaved people landing somewhere near Jamestown, Virginia. But did you know that by 1790, American cotton production had grown to 1.5 million pounds a year? Has anybody on the stage ever held a freshly picked piece of cotton in your hand? And I don't mean something out of an aspirin bottle, but like out of a field, no twigs. How much does it weigh? I can't tell you how many cotton balls that weigh near nothing it took to get to 1.5 million pounds, but I can tell you how many enslaved people it took, 700,000. In 171 years, America went from 20 and odd enslaved people to 700,000. And the details behind this story are part of what we will paint in the documentary with historical documents. Many people will say, if you're talking about the history of enslavement in America, you really can't talk about the colonies because that wasn't America yet. America didn't happen until we broke away from England. And what I'd like you to think about in terms of the arc of this story is that the white supremacy that was at the heart of the in economic life of the colonial Americans was doubled down upon when we wrote our Constitution. Article 1, Section 2 is the three-fifths clause. Every black person in America was counted as three-fifths of a human being. If I asked people in this room before I started this presentation, what is affirmative action? Almost all of us would say, oh, those were programs of uplift in the 60s and 70s directed at the black community. And then at some point the U.S. Supreme Court said, hey, that's reverse discrimination, and now there's kind of a balance. I'm not quite sure where it is. Many Americans think affirmative action started in the 1960s. Can you think of a more powerful form of affirmative action than giving one race of people the right to own another race? Article 1, Section 9, no ban on migration or importation of such persons before 1808. The word slavery, enslaved or slave, did not appear in the Constitution until the 13th Amendment. We'll get to that in a minute. Because the North understood that the South was upset by that word. It was kind of harsh. And so enslaved people were referred to as such persons. And no ban on migration meant that we need to keep the ships going to Africa to bring more enslaved people back because we are getting rich off of this. We can't cut this trade off until 1808. Article 2, Section 1. Each state shall appoint a number of electors equal to the number. One reason, to give the southern states a guarantee that they would have a significant role in electing the president of the United States. And here is where you will hear letters from people like Patrick Henry. Remember him, y'all? Give me liberty or give me death. Well, when the Constitutional Convention was happening, people thought they were doing something important. So they wrote stuff down. And Al Gore hadn't invented the internet yet, so people had to write letters to each other. And Patrick Henry, you will see in the documentary, an actor reading Patrick Henry's letter about there are 236,000 blacks in Virginia, and fewer none in the northern states. Multiply 236,000 by three-fifths, and you still get a big number, especially considering the size of America at the time. This was done directly to further the interest of the slave-owning states. Article 4, Section 2, no freedom for any runaway slave must be returned on demand. And I was telling Art earlier, I've been giving this presentation or some version of it for 7 or 8 years, and I have just realized recently that this document says an incredible thing. This part of the Constitution makes it clear that from the first day that this country came into existence, America turned to its law enforcement officers and said, your job is to control, contain, and suppress every black face in America. We wrote it in the Constitution. Because if there's no freedom for a runaway, what does that mean? The United States Marshals Service is on you to bring you back to your owner. And finally, people say the folks that wrote the Constitution were brilliant, and they were. Go back to Article 1, Section 9. No state could pass a law saying you can't bring enslaved people from Africa into our state, because that would be unconstitutional. But these folks were wily. They said, what if folks try and amend the Constitution? And so they doubled down, and they said, you can't amend Article 1, Section 9 until after 1808. They were going to keep those ships coming. The word slavery is mentioned once in the 13th Amendment, which did not rid America of slavery. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as punishment for a crime, shall exist within the United States. That means that slavery and involuntary servitude do exist for people who have been convicted of a crime. Think about the new Jim Crow and mass incarceration in the light of this amendment. This was not done by mistake. And the documentary will demonstrate people knew exactly what they were doing when they wrote this amendment. So I wish I could see a show of hands. How many people know who the Colonial Marines were? I am trying to demonstrate how we have been deprived of the truth about our history. If you were never taught who the Colonial Marines were. The Colonial Marines were escaped enslaved people that fought for the British in the War of Independence and during the War of 1812. Why? Because the British said, if we win, you get your freedom. And the Colonial Marines in the War of 1812 were part of British troops that attacked the Americans right outside of Washington, D.C., drove them back into Washington, D.C., and set the White House on fire. And one of the people who was watching that happen was Francis Scott Key. And 3.5 weeks later, he was in Baltimore Harbor watching the bombing of Fort McHenry. And after 25 consecutive hours of bombing, when he saw the American flag still flying, he became overcome with patriotic fervor, and he wrote the poem that became the national anthem.
And where is that band who so vauntingly swore that the havoc of war and the battle of home and country should leave us no more. Their blood has washed out their foul footsteps' pollution. No
No refuge can save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight, because we will hunt you down, or the gloom of the grave, because we will put you in the dirt if you dare fight against America for your freedom. And there are historians who will be anxious to tell you, well, Francis Scott Key wasn't talking about those enslaved people. He was talking about some other enslaved people. Francis Scott Key was a virulent racist. Francis Scott Key prosecuted a man in Washington, D.C. after the Civil War for possessing abolitionist literature, which carried the death penalty. Francis Scott Key called black Americans the worst plight to ever be inflicted on America. This is who wrote our national anthem, and these are the words. We may not sing them anymore, but they're there. And if you didn't know this, I wonder what you might think of black athletes who kneel quietly protesting racial injustice, knowing that this is our national anthem. And in the documentary, we will use all kinds of evidence to demonstrate just how much America relied on enslaving people. But this is an example of what it was about. The 1856 unique defense to the charge of murder that was put forward on behalf of Margaret Garner. And what Margaret Garner did is best described by a newspaper article from the Cincinnati Enquirer from 1856.
Great excitement existed throughout the city the whole day of yesterday in consequence of the arrest of a party of slaves and the murder of her child by a slave mother while officers were in the act of making the arrest. A party of 17 slaves escaped from Boone and Kenton counties in Kentucky about 16 miles from the Ohio on Sunday night last, and taking with them two horses and a sled, drove that night to the Ohio River opposite to Western Row in this city. Leaving the horses and sled standing there, they crossed the river on foot,
crossed the river
on the ice, on foot on the ice.
One of the narratives in America that has been very popular is that, yes, slavery was a bad thing, but it wasn't that bad. There were like good living conditions, and they had good food, and they were treated okay. Just how bad does it have to be for you to take your family and cross the Ohio River in the middle of the winter on foot, on the ice, not knowing if the ice will break, for you to fall through? It was bad enough that Margaret Garner and her family took that risk. And when the U.S. Marshals showed up the next day in Cincinnati to arrest her, as the Constitution required them to do, Margaret Garner took a knife, grabbed her daughter, and slit her throat. Then she went after her sons, and the Marshals got to her before she could complete her task. This is an oil painting, a rendering of what Margaret Garner did, experienced. And Alfre Woodard helped us with reading that poem at the event in Town Hall in New York.
Then, said the mournful mother, if Ohio cannot save, I will do a deed for freedom. She shall find each child a grave. I will save my precious children from their darkly threatened doom. I will hew their path to freedom through the portals of the tomb. A moment in the sunlight, she held a glimmering knife. The next moment she had bathed it in the crimson fount of life. They snatched away the fatal knife. Her boys shrieked, wild with dread. The baby girl was pale and cold. They raised it up. The child was dead. Send this deed for fearful daring through my country's heart, no thrill. Do the icy hands of slavery every pure emotion chill?
Like this. This is what slavery was. It wasn't something else. This is who we are as Americans when we talk about our history, because Margaret Garner was charged with first-degree murder for killing her daughter, and the murder charges were dismissed. Because in order to be convicted of first-degree murder, you have to kill a human being. And what Margaret Garner killed was an enslaved child. So Margaret Garner, her husband, and her three sons were returned to their owners to live out the rest of the Civil War.
And we are still dealing with this debate. 57% of Americans saying that Confederate flag is a symbol of Southern pride. Well, let's remember, that flag disappeared until 1948, and who brought it back? Strom Thurmond and the Dixiecrat Party. And what was their platform? We stand for segregation of the races. They knew what this flag stood for.
Slavery had nothing to do with the war. That was not the cause of the Southern states seceding. That was not the cause of the first shot being fired on that fort over there. It was about money. And it was not about slavery. It was about moral terrorists. It was about more money. Lincoln wanted to impose 45% more taxes on the Southern states.
Taxes on the goods the Southern states were producing. And those goods were essentially cotton, tobacco, and rice.
Slavery had nothing to do.
And those goods were produced by slave labor. All of it. Isn't that right?
I mean, the
95% of it? Isn't that right? If it's 95% produced by slave labor, enslaved people, and the North is saying, we're going to tax you on that because we want some of that money, and the South is saying, no, wait a minute, we're the ones producing it, so you shouldn't be taking the money. That money wouldn't exist without slave labor. I mean, that did affect the bottom line. Wouldn't you agree with that?
They chose to stay. In most cases in the South, that's the way it worked, because they were treated as family, and they knew what they had. They didn't know what they were being faced with if they left.
So your view is that enslaved people treated as family? Then why wouldn't it be all right for me to own you as long as I treated you like family?
If that's the way economics work?
Would you be satisfied with that?
In today's world.
In any world.
In today's time.
In any time.
Charleston, South Carolina was the port through which almost 40% of every African American enslaved person that came to this country came through. This is on the waterfront in Charleston, South Carolina. These men are there demonstrating every weekend, every Sunday. Cars drive by, beep horns, yell out words of encouragement, and their view is that the Civil War had nothing to do with enslaving people and that enslaved people were treated as family. This conversation was difficult because literally the day before we had been to the Charleston Slave Mart Museum. And trust me, this is not how family was treated.
We are standing in front of the Chalmers Street entrance of the old Slave Mart Museum. This structure and this complex was created as a response to the outdoor sale of enslaved populations within the city of Charleston. By the 1850s, the outdoor sale of enslaved people that had been going on since the founding of the colony in 1670 was being seen as somewhat of an aberrant eyesore. Now, what is a large parking lot behind this building today was originally a massive pen that contained a four-story jail building utilized to house enslaved people prior to the day of sale. There was a two-story kitchen building back there for nutritional needs, as well as prepping the enslaved, and a morgue building, or more accurately, a dead house, for sick and dying enslaved. They would sell enslaved people out of this location 6 days a week, Monday through Saturday. Everyone from newborns to 70-year-olds were sold out of here. For enslaved people to make the most money for the traders and for the sellers, they have to be prepped first. Prep could be everything from high fat and high protein diets to get them into better physical shape, as well as, you know, fresh clothing. you have the sort of prepping of the skin through oiling. If they're looking a little bit older, they could either dye the hair or pluck any grays that someone would have, things of that nature, in order to, when they come up onto the block, they're able to garner the largest amount of money.
And I'm looking at a list of Negroes,
mm-hmm.
and it says, number one, the name is Sunday, the age is 45.
Enslaved people, they didn't have last names generally until the 1870 census. And so it was the question of, what is your name?
Because the names could be changed each time you were sold?
They would be changed. That's the first thing that is changed every time you're sold. So on all broadsides you will ever see, this is just the name they come to the sale with. And keep in mind that the enslaved property of slave owners was worth more than everything else they owned. It was worth more than the plantation. It was more than the land, more than the goods that are produced on that plantation, more than the house, more than any other liveries that they have. So the first thing that's going to be sold to pay for a debt is, you know, enslaved. Because you didn't have to buy them outright. You could mortgage them. So this is representative of a pricing chart. There are four factors that define how much an enslaved person is ultimately sold for. The first is age. The younger you are, because it's a future investment, the more valuable you are. Also, there's something called prime. It was enslaved individuals from about the age of 10 to 12 to the age of about 25. For males, it was the amount of work they can do in that time. You're very strong, you're very virile. And for females, it's the amount of children they can produce. And so you have the subcategories based on age, skills, health, and skin tone. So when it came to movement of enslaved prior to being brought onto that block, they're going to be chained.
Mm-hmm.
Now everyone's going to be chained. It's not just going to be grown-ups. It's not going to be the elderly. It'll also be the children.
And so I think what I'm looking at are shackles that were designed for an adult male and shackles that were designed for a child of maybe 3 or 4.
Yes, yes. And again, you know, as I mentioned, that blacksmithing was a job that enslaved people would do. They could be in charge of making shackles.
Let's go upstairs.
Sure.
Well, how hard is it for you to work here and do this every day? Because it has to take a toll.
It does. It does.
I get that.
Yeah. But I'm also really lucky. This is a physical aspect of control. This is the end piece of a very large whip. It was originally about 6 feet long. And if you look very closely, there are braided bits.
Yes.
There are nails driven into the leather wrap. And that would act as a way to both stiffen it, but also to bite into the skin.
Easter, I would like to ask, what are the three holes that I see in these bricks in the walls there?
They're fingerprints. Enslaved people would begin to learn a skill at the age of about 6.
Mm-hmm.
And so fingerprints and handprints and thumbprints exist all throughout the city because enslaved people build the city. As you can see, my fingers don't fit because this brick was not made by an adult.
It was made by a child.
Yes. Yes. And so on churches, on businesses, in alleyways, you see these in theaters, you see these all throughout the city in very, very subtle ways. And if you don't know what you're looking for, you may not see them.
But they're there.
Absolutely. And they are a way of the enslaved who created this city and created the economy that created this country to remind us, hey, I was here too.
That is an example of what we are going to try and do with the time period from colonial times to the Civil War. And one of the things that Art and I were talking about earlier is that we talked about America's reaction to things like when the movie Roots came out and when other things have come out. And America has, it seems like for a moment, looked and said, my God, that's really horrible, and then moved on. And part of it is because I think we have been insufficient in making, or we have not worked hard enough to make the connections from 1619 to 2020. And part of the purpose of this documentary is to try and make those connections, to say to people, there is a direct and unbroken line from the white supremacy that let the colonial Americans get rich by bringing enslaved people from Africa to the white supremacy that exists today. And if that unbroken line can be established, I think you get people to a different place. The end of the connection to the Civil War, by 1861, remember in 1790, 1.5 million pounds of cotton a year? By 1861, it was 2.3 billion pounds a year. 60% of all U.S. exports. Folks, this is how America got rich. The number of enslaved people was now 4 million. I'm not saying, let's be clear, that America enslaved 4 million people between 1619 and 1861. It was much, much more than that. I'm saying there were 4 million alive in 1861. The value of enslaved people in 1861, $3.5 billion, more than all the money in circulation in America at the time, and worth more than $100 billion in today's money. The richest part of America, most millionaires per capita, the Mississippi Valley. Tennessee, Mississippi, and Louisiana, one of the poorest places in America today because the labor of enslaved people has never been replaced in those economies. And understand, enslaved people were more than just free labor. You had to buy them, and so you take out a loan, and you had to pay interest on the loan. You had to take out insurance policies. The sales were taxed and notarized. Everybody was making this money. And so let's skip forward, because the documentary will not do the skipping. We will cover more area after the Civil War. But let's skip forward to the first half of the 20th century, and I want to talk about the Tulsa Massacre. I guarantee you, many, many, many Americans learned about the Tulsa Massacre from watching something called The Watchmen on HBO. And what I'll say that's great and bad about that, on the one hand, I can't believe it takes a cartoon movie for America to learn about one of the worst mass killings in our history. On the other hand, if that's what informed people and they now know about it, at least they now know. The Greenwood neighborhood of Tulsa, Oklahoma, was one of the richest neighborhoods in America in 1921. I didn't say one of the richest black neighborhoods in America. I said one of the richest neighborhoods in America. 1921, there were businesses, churches, restaurants, grocery stores, movie theaters, private airplanes. There was a hospital. There was a post office. There were schools, libraries, a law office. They even had a bus system. On May 31st, 1921, a young black man was arrested for supposedly assaulting a white woman. And you can go back and look at the newspapers, even that were written then. And at most, this young man bumped into this woman and she screamed. The narrative in the black community, of course, is that they were involved with each other and they were kissing, and another white person walked into the elevator and she had to scream. At any rate, this young man was arrested and taken down to the jail. And a lynch mob was formed. But what they forgot was that the black men in the Greenwood area of Tulsa, Oklahoma, had served in World War I, and they still had their long rifles. and they were trained in military efficiency. And they came down and surrounded the courthouse and kept the lynch mob out. Not one white person was injured that night. A shot was fired when there was a scuffle over a gun, a white man saying to one of the black men, "Boy, what are you going to do with that gun?" And the black man responding, "Use it if I have to." The lynch mob was turned away, and the next day, the Greenwood neighborhood of Tulsa, Oklahoma, was burned to the ground. Many people think it was a street, Black Wall Street. It was 4 square miles that were burned to the ground. And in doing our research, we came across in an old Fox movie tone file actual footage that was filmed on June 1st, 1921 in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Virtually every person you see in that picture had their home burned to the ground. Yeah, they didn't do much preserving of order. They were a little late for that. This gets me. Look at the look on this man's face. And if you want some resilience out of all of this, children will be children no matter what's happening. Look at the little girl in the middle of the screen, and she's just kind of dancing and jumping up and down, and the little girl at the end of the line dancing, because kids will find joy almost anywhere.
To be honest, this is probably going to be the, and I'm saying this at this table, the most pro-black president that we've had in our lifetime.
So had that asked me, I would have said, you know, before you praise this president for being pro-black, before you praise this president for caring about ethnic communities and marginalized populations, do your homework. Well, some of y'all didn't do your homework. They didn't do their homework. So let me tell you just a little bit of research, not just him personally, but also some of his policies. Perhaps before they went and sat at this table, they should have done their homework. Because if they had done their homework, they would have known that President Trump has ramped up mass incarceration by instructing Attorney General Jeff Sessions to revitalize the war on drugs. They would have known that of the 87 picks for federal judges, 85 have been white and just one has been black and one has been Hispanic. They would have known that President Trump supported the Department of Justice engaging in unlawful voter purges, making it difficult for blacks to go and vote. They would have known that Trump is ending protection for predatory lenders, which disproportionately harm black people. They would have have known that he is ignoring the affordable housing crisis by ordering HUD to triple the rents of poor tenants in public housing, which mostly affect black people. Do your homework. They would have known that he is proposing cutting $200 billion over the next 10 years from supplemental nutrition assistance programs that will bring more hunger in black and brown communities. They would have known that Trump is worsening the health of black communities through environmental deregulation, which disproportionately harms black people through exposure to pollution. Now, that's just a few on the policy side, but you don't have to go too far to ask what about him personally would make me know that he is not pro-black. I'm glad you asked, because in 1970, Trump's real estate company tried to avoid renting apartments to black tenants and gave preferential treatment to white tenants. He began his 2016 presidential campaign with a speech disparaging Mexican immigrants as criminals and rapists. Y'all remember that? In 2016, he said of people of color, you are living in poverty, your schools are no good, you have no jobs. Hold on, I'm a product of a HBCU, and I'm a product of black school systems and black teachers. Don't you ever tell me that my black schools are... Hold on, I ain't done. He says you have no jobs, so what do you have to lose from electing me? In 2017, Trump said 15,000 recent immigrants from Haiti all have AIDS, and 40,000 Nigerians once seeing the United States would want to go back to their huts in Africa. He spent years suggesting that the nation's first black president was not a citizen of these United States. He called Puerto Ricans, who's criticized his administration's response to Hurricane Maria, he called them politically motivated ingrates. Hold on, but he called those who marched beside white supremacists in Charlottesville, Virginia, he called them very fine people. He hired Steve Bannon, a white nationalist, as his chief strategist. He called Haiti and other African nations S-hole countries, and he's taking credit for an economy that has not been built on his administration, but was built on the backs of 8 years of hard work under the Obama administration. Negroes, please, don't you come up in here talking about this is the most pro-black president that you have ever seen, when the record suggests that he cares nothing about people of color.
Child, you just stand. I hunger for your love. what's really happening. Make it like it was the way it used to be when I hungered for your
I'm The view from up here is so clear and real. The sense of falling fast is all that I can feel. And yet I want to keep on riding. Me how to be myself, for all the ways you made it clear that no one else can touch me quite the way you do. Like my first time on a parent's wing, the view from up here. Falling fast is all that I can feel, and yet I want to keep on flying. Now I see how lonely I have been. All that I needed was a love who's a friend. Your eyes can help me find.
by the night. We almost lost it. Once again, we can take the night into
love was all. Again, even if only in my heart. Before the heavens open up, we might just find that we're still in love. Oh, if you love me, I believe that one day you'll be back in my arms, love. I don't care how long, I'll just keep holding on until you are. Oh, if you love me, I believe that we're not over while we're apart. It might not be small, but you're still my lady. It's only in my heart. It's only in my heart. Only in my heart. It's only in my heart. You're still my number one. If only, 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 I keep a photo in my wallet of us two. I keep on dreaming, every dream I have is you. Keep saying I'll throw it away, but never do. Keep wondering when did I become the shameless fool. Keep saying, do you ever think of me at all? Keep praying that it's you each time that someone calls. Keep thinking, why the hell are we even apart? I keep holding out hope for us, if only in my heart. Before the heavens open up, we might just find that we're still in love. If you let me, I believe that one day you'll be back in my arms, love. I don't care how long, I'll just keep holding on until you are. Oh, if you let me, I believe that we're not over while we're apart. It might not be small, but you're still my lady. It's only in my heart. It's only in my heart. Only in my heart. It's only in my heart. You're still my number one. My you're still years of the pillow of the man that never find the stuff of diamonds. Right out of his hand. Call me a fool, and I don't know what to do without a hand next to me. Oh no, no. My body used to keep me warm. I'm gonna wait every day until you're right back in my arms. Oh, if you love me, I believe that one day you'll be back in my arms. I don't care how long, I'll just keep holding on until you are. Oh, if you love me, I believe that we're not over while we're apart. It might not be small, but you're still my lady. It's only in my heart. It's only in my heart. Only in my heart. If only in my heart. You're still my number one. You're still, still
singer.
I've been thinking heavy, how show me you grow. I've been kissing, touching up on, hugging up on, thinking up on. She won't love, I've been too distant. Shawty, why you tripping? Why you tripping? See, I done did everything for you. You playing these games with me too. Your emotions getting stressful, so she don't really want love for her. I said I saw you sleep.
just beginning, and I know we've each been down this road a time or two, and never could make it through. I've got this feeling that we're stumbling to what we've both been waiting for, and maybe even more. It doesn't matter where we've been, 'cause this time I know for sure we're going all the way, headed for forever, and that's the more you hear me, the more I know it. We got it all here, we just don't blow it. We're going all the way. If the pillow of thoughts don't want it, I'd lay my money on it, starting today. That there's more than magic in these feelings that we found, standing on solid ground. But now we're both ready, ready for the real thing, 'cause our dues have all been paid. We finally got it made. Believe me when I tell you there's no need to be afraid. We're going all the way. We're headed for forever, and that's where we're gonna stay. The more you hear me, the more I know it. We got it all here, we just don't blow it. We're going all the way. If the two of us together through whatever comes, I know we got the staying power. We're gonna make tomorrow ours if we just stick with it and give it all we got to give. We're going all the way. If the
well, you just said
and there's nothing left to do. You just stand and watch the Lord see you through. Yes, after you've done all you can, you just tell me, how do you handle guilt of your past? Tell me, how do you deal with the shame? And how can you smile while your heart has been broken and filled with pain? You're giving your own chance. Seems like you can't make it through. Child, you just stand when there's nothing left to do. You just stand once the Lord sees you through. Yes, after you've done all you can, you just
just stand.